I will call to order the Tuesday, March 14th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. The first bill that we will have today on our agenda is House File 812. I will move House File 812 to be re-referred to HHS Finance. Representative Keel, your bill is before the committee. If you'll proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Get myself organized here. Just one of those days. Mr. Chair and members, House File 812 is a licensure for certain facilities that perform abortions, 10 or more abortions. Our intent is to add protection for the safety of women. These facilities are for one-day procedures that women should be handled as outpatient surgical centers. We are asking for the same rules as an outpatient surgical center. With that, I am going to ask Ms. Rao to testify.
Ms. Rao, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. We are Minnesota's oldest and largest pro-life organization, and I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak here today. I would like to urge the committee to pass House File 812, which requires that Minnesota abortion facilities be licensed and inspected by the state. More than 40 years ago, the United States Supreme Court handed down the Roe versus Wade decision, legalizing abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason. Supporters of the decision were pleased that women would no longer have to engage in unsanitary, illegal, and unsafe abortions. So I ask the committee today, how is it that not very long ago, a grand jury report regarding a Pennsylvania abortion facility, the doctor who ran it, and several of his staff was able to stun our nation, pro-life and pro-choice alike, by shedding light on the unsanitary, illegal, and unsafe abortions that were happening at a clinic there. Dr. Gosnell, who ran the facility, and others were found guilty of a variety of charges and were sent to prison. I will spare the committee details on how Gosnell killed viable babies accidentally born alive, but I will share with you that the district attorney in Philadelphia referred to the clinic as, quote, decrepit and unsanitary, staffed entirely with unlicensed personnel. According to the United States Supreme Court, quote, Gosnell's deplorable crimes could escape detection only because his facility went uninspected for more than 15 years. Pennsylvania had a law requiring inspection of abortion facilities, but for political reasons, the inspections didn't happen. Remember, Minnesota doesn't even have an inspection requirement for abortion facilities. Within the last month or so, a pair of news reports centered on different industries highlighted a lack of state inspections as leading to significant problems. First, a Carrie Levin story focused on uninspected nail salons and a woman who lost 4 fingernails. When an inspection was finally done in the nail salon, 28 violations were found, including half the staff being unlicensed. A few days later, the Pioneer Press published a story on the lack of investigations into complaints at nursing homes. I'm guessing that several of you are well aware of this, as the legislature has looked into this issue as well. According to MDH budget request, quote, thousands of complaints are not investigated, so maltreatment continues and less severe issues may escalate to more serious harm. When looking at abortion facilities, it is important to note that most patients won't even bother to file a complaint, even if they have significant concerns with something that happened at an abortion facility. We know this anecdotally. Think of how long Gosnell's clinic operated before being shut down, and intuitively. Unlike patients who go to a clinic and have an ongoing relationship with the facility and the medical staff, but very much like others who receive care at an outpatient surgical center, abortion facility patients typically have a one-day relationship with the facility. They go for their procedure and they don't plan to go back. This in itself is a reason why many abortion patients are less likely to report a problem with a facility. But when you add to the fact that women who have abortions typically tell few people and don't want others to know, you end up with a scenario where women are very unlikely to report problems. This is a key reason why we need inspections, along with basic licensing requirements. Some have suggested that this legislation may be unconstitutional based on a recent U.S. Supreme Court case. However, I would like to point out a few key differences. The Supreme Court took great effort to evaluate a number of facts as they related to the law in Texas, and their ruling was very much based upon those facts. Additionally, the court recognized that, quote, the constitutionality of a statute predicated upon the existence of a particular state of facts may be challenged by showing to the court that those facts have ceased to exist. The plain fact is that the facts in Texas vary greatly from the facts in Minnesota. In regard to whether or not a woman's health was protected by the new law, in Texas, the court said, quote, women will not obtain better care or experience more frequent positive outcomes at an ambulatory surgical center as compared to a previously licensed facility. You see, Texas already required the licensure of abortion facilities, as well as inspections. The court ruled that the health of women wasn't further protected by the new regulations because such regulations already existed. This is not the case in Minnesota. Second, the court ruled that an undue burden existed in Texas after passage of the law because of two key issues. One, included in the new Texas law was a requirement that abortion facilities obtain admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Many abortion facilities were refused admitting privileges and thus would be forced to shut down. And two, although Texas had previously waived parts of the regulations for nearly two-thirds of covered facilities, they refused to allow such waivers for abortion facilities. This also was forcing a number of abortion facilities to close. These two facts would not be part of the Minnesota story. Our legislation does not include an admitting privileges provision. And our regulatory structure does allow for some regulations to be waived at the discretion of MDH, so long as they don't interfere with the health and safety of the patient. When looking at these significant differences, it is very reasonable to believe that the court would uphold the legislation before you today. The truth is that the women of Minnesota deserve the assurance that they will never walk into a facility that has the unsanitary, illegal, and unsafe conditions that were found at the facility in Pennsylvania. But that assurance simply isn't guaranteed under our current law. However, it can be provided through common sense licensing and inspection standards for abortion facilities that provide 10 or more abortions per month. These are the abortion facilities that act like an outpatient surgical center. The legislation before you today would merely require such facilities to be inspected by the state and subject to the same outpatient surgical center requirements. On behalf of MCCL's many grassroots supporters and a number of students here today, I urge the committee to support House File 812. Thank you.
Representative Keel, does that conclude your setup on the bill this morning? Did you have other testifiers that you'd like to bring forward with your bill this morning?
No, I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, then what we'll do is we'll ask Ms. Rao to stand by in case we have some member questions. I did have one person who signed up to testify, and that is Andrea Ledger, and I'll ask Ms. Ledger to come forward at this time. And if anyone else would like to speak on the matter before the committee today, House File 812, you're invited to do so. See James, and he will get you signed up and in queue to be able to do that. So, again, if you are interested in testifying on the matter today, see James. Good morning, Ms. Ledger. Am I pronouncing it correct, Ledger?
You are, like a bank ledger.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, Chair Driscoll and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Andrea Ledger. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. We represent more than 60,000 Minnesotans throughout the state, and our mission is to guarantee that every woman has the ability to make personal decisions regarding the full range of reproductive choices, including legal abortion, preventing unintended pregnancy, and bearing healthy children. And I'm here to testify against House File 812. This bill is clearly unconstitutional under the U.S. Supreme Court's undue burden standard, which was reaffirmed by a 5-3 vote just last year in Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. Whole Woman's Health challenged two parts of a Texas law known as HB 2. The first was an admitting privileges provision, and the second was a requirement that licensed abortion facilities meet hospital-like building standards. The latter of these was identical to the bill you are considering today. In Whole Woman's Health, the Supreme Court clarified that the undue burden test is a form of heightened scrutiny. Only laws that further a valid state interest, confer benefits that outweigh burdens to the patient, and are based on credible evidence meet that standard. The court found that, quote, the surgical center requirement, like the admitting privileges requirement, provides few, if any, health benefits to women, poses a substantial obstacle to women seeking abortions, and constitutes an undue burden on their constitutional right to do so. Just as with Texas HB 2, the stated goals of the bill before you are not medically justified and will not provide any health benefits to women. What the bill will do is close clinics. If enacted, four of the five abortion clinics in Minnesota will be forced to close due to the expense of meeting surgical center requirements. You have written testimony from the Women's Health Center of Duluth, the only abortion clinic in greater Minnesota, that the cost for them to upgrade would be upwards of $800,000. This bill would further cost Minnesota taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars to millions of dollars in legal fees. In at least eight states around the country, courts have used the Whole Woman's Health decision to block abortion restrictions, and state advocates and health departments have used the decision to repeal regulations that conflict with the legal standard established in Whole Woman's Health. States have spent millions defending against unconstitutional restrictions on abortions, both in their own legal fees and in judgments to pay the law's challengers' legal fees. In 2016, Wisconsin agreed to pay $1.6 million to Planned Parenthood and other challengers of an unconstitutional admitting privileges bill. This bill is unconstitutional, does not protect women's health, and could cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend. For all these reasons, Governor Dayton vetoed a similar bill in 2012, and I urge you to oppose it.
Ms. Ledger, thank you. I'm going to ask you as well to stand by in case there are some member questions that come up. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on the matter before the committee this morning? House File 812. Anyone wishing to testify? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Mason, followed by Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. My thought is we want everybody to be safe in Minnesota, so why wouldn't you extend this requirement to all clinics to the representative?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. It is the same how we address outpatient surgical centers. Same, that's all we're asking for. Is the same licensure.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Representative Pugh, followed by Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Keel, for bringing this bill. I'm just going to start with a comment, and I'm sure I may have more questions when we get going. But I have spoken with a number of women who have had abortions, and I think the very last thing that they probably even thought of was whether or not the facility had been inspected. In fact, when I heard that you were bringing this bill forward, I thought about a young woman, a very young woman that I spoke with. And I know for a fact that she was so distraught about the decision that she was about to, just the condition, you know, that she found herself in, and so overwhelmed, she wasn't even thinking clearly at all, let alone about if the facility had been, you know, inspected or any of that, of course. And I just think that is, it's really unconscionable. Most of the young women that I know, at least for the many years that I've lived here in Minnesota, are accustomed to going to, you know, any of the clinics or hospitals around, and you know, it's just amazingly, impeccably clean and everything. And so that is, I'm certain, what a woman making a decision, the tough decision in most cases, to make to have an abortion. That's what she's assuming is the case. So the fact that that isn't the case, I think, puts women at risk and in a big way. And I'm most grateful for your bill, and thank you.
Representative Halverson, followed by Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Keough. We've discussed this bill in years past, and I find it troubling that we're bringing an unconstitutional bill forward. But beyond that, what other procedures are performed in clinic settings that you can name for us that might need to be regulated?
Representative Keough.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, I believe all outpatient surgical centers require are licensed, and that's all we're asking of that. I hesitate to list whatever all the procedures that happen, but they are equally invasive, and we need to make sure that they are following all of the protections for the people seeking surgical procedure.
Representative Halverson,
well,
follow-up.
Mr. Chair and Representative Keough, tooth extractions do not happen in outpatient surgical centers in most situations. They happen in a dentist's office. Do you anticipate that those dentist's offices are somehow not clean enough or safe enough to provide that procedure and need to be regulated further?
Representative Keough.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, we're not asking about a tooth extraction to begin with. Secondly, we're asking for the facility to be licensed exactly like an outpatient surgical center, no more, no less.
Representative Halverson, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, that's true. This bill does not cover tooth extractions, but interestingly enough, when you look at data with regard to risk to life and health, tooth extractions actually would be statistically more dangerous than abortion procedures. Tooth extractions and abortion procedures are performed by licensed medical personnel in both their fields. And the physicians have told us time and time again, I know I've asked you before, the physicians expressed concern. Are physicians seeing need for follow-up in hospital because of risks that people are exposed to with abortions? And the answer from clinics, hospitals, and the Department of Health is no. And so if we are going to be truly talking about the safety and health of the patient, I think that you need to be looking at what procedures are risky to a patient, and looking at a regulatory scheme from that perspective, as opposed to just randomly choosing a procedure that you don't want people to have access to. And if you don't want people to have access to abortion, that's fine, and I think that that's an opinion and a debate that we can have at the state. But to say that this is about patient safety when we know that there are other procedures that are performed in clinical settings that are statistically riskier. I won't say that a tooth extraction is a super risky procedure, but statistically, if you were going to talk about the number of people who are injured or who have a fatal reaction during procedures, that is more risky. And so I really urge you, if you are talking about the health of a patient, then talk about the health of a patient, and don't pick a procedure based on whether or not you agree with it.
Representative Keough, did you want to respond? There wasn't a question, but certainly give you a chance to respond to the statement if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say we're just asking for it to be licensed like an outpatient center. And I would suggest that Representative Halverson check her facts, because it's much more risky, if you look at the facts, than supporters of abortion would like to believe.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, could you tell me a little bit about why you included a severability clause on lines 2.32 to 3.5 in the bill?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Iwakim, that's standard for these types of bills. We did, I can't remember another bill recently that we did in the last couple of years, but that's just an automatic that we put in.
Representative Iwakim, follow up?
Mr. Chair, I'd argue that that's not standard when drafting a bill. Severability clauses are put in there when the author or folks think that part of it is not going to be held up by the Supreme Court, and maybe this question would be better suited to Ms. Rao, if she could come forward, please.
Ms. Ralph, will state your name, and then Representative Iwakim.
Andrea Rao with MCCL.
Proceed, Representative Iwakim.
Hello, Ms. Rao. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Ms. Rao. You stated the Halstead ruling down in Texas the Supreme Court upheld and mentioned that. Could you explain to me why you think this is different?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Iwakim and members of the committee, I think I went through several reasons in my testimony. On why it is different, including the fact that this bill does not have an admitting privileges provision, that Hellerstad was based also on the fact that in Texas they already had some licensing and inspection regulations, which is not the case here in Minnesota. And so they had that. And the additional law on top of it, the court ruled, did nothing to further protect women because they already had that licensing and inspection structure, which we don't have.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Ms. Rao, then why the severability clause if you have no concern that it's going to be ruled unconstitutional?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin and members of the committee, I think it's pretty clear from the testimony today and testimony at pretty much every committee that I have ever been a part of on our pro-life legislation, that there's always a threat that pro-life legislation will be challenged in the courts. And so it is standard for pro-life legislation to have a severability clause.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Rao, I can understand that, but I think, you know, and I'm not a lawyer. I'm not sure if you're a lawyer either.
I am not.
And I'm not sure if Ms. Ledger is a lawyer, but if you look at the Supreme Court ruling on its face, one of the number one things that they note is that the anti-abortion restrictions must be examined for the burdens they impose on women, not just the purported benefits. And when you talk about a clinic up in Duluth that could be closed and have women having to go miles and miles and miles to get not just this procedure but any other health procedure, that is quite a great burden that it does impose. So I think the severability clause is in there because you know not only will it be challenged, but it will be ruled unconstitutional. Thank you.
Again, I didn't hear a question specifically. Ms. Rao, our Representative Keel, if you ever want to respond to that, we'll certainly give you the chance to do that. If not, you don't have to.
Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joaquin, members of the committee, I would just say that, you know, I know the center in Duluth, as well as potentially others, are claiming that they would be closed if this legislation were to become law. I don't think they know that. There is a waiver that is allowed in that allows the Department of Health, which would be doing the licensing and inspection, to weigh the benefits versus the potential costs. And so long as the safety and health of women remains protected, they have the ability to weigh the number of the more costly changes that would be required. So I don't know that anyone can say definitively that any abortion facility would be closed because of this legislation.
Having been no public testimony and having no more member questions, oh, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, and maybe to you or your testifier, the testimony referenced the Duluth Clinic and something about it potentially being, was it closed or is it, I'm unclear about that. I'm wondering if there are any findings or if relative to being substandard in any way. I'm just really unclear about what's happening there in Duluth.
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, and members of the committee, all I can go by is a letter that the clinic in Duluth submitted as written testimony saying that they thought that they would close if this were to become law. As I was just explaining to Representative Joachim, I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that they are looking at the rules that they would be asked to follow and saying that their facility as it currently exists would have to undergo some substantial renovations in order to meet all of those. But as I stated previously, so long as the safety and health of the women is protected according to the Department of Health, number of those more costly renovations could be waived for the facility.
Representative Pugh, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have another question that's not a follow-up, but I'm wondering if a woman is concerned in any way about the procedure that she had, the abortion that she had, how would she file a claim or a suit or whatever that would look like against her abortionist? I mean, as I'm thinking about this and the relationships that I've had with, you know, my doctors, I mean, I know who they are. I've seen them repeatedly, or at least even if I see a new doctor, it's at the same clinic because my doctor's not available. So I would imagine that this is a one-time, maybe more for some experience for women. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, what that looks like.
Ms. Rao.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Pugh, I think this is one of the reasons that this legislation is really important. Because, first of all, I think that, as I testified to previously as well, I think most women are unlikely to file any complaint, even if they do have a problem, because it is they're anticipating a one-time procedure at a clinic that they don't usually go to, and they don't want to talk about it. They want it to be over. They want it to be behind them, and so they're unlikely to file a complaint. But if they felt inclined to, I think there are still some difficulties for them, in particular that they may not even know the name of the doctor that did the procedure. We have an informed consent law here in Minnesota, but even under that law, you may not necessarily be told the name of the doctor performing the procedure. And so it could be very difficult if you wanted to file a complaint with the Board of Medical Practice it could be difficult not even knowing the name of that physician.
Representative Pugh, follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Joachim, followed by Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair O'Driscoll. Actually, this question might be best suited to Ms. Ledger.
We'll recall Ms. Ledger. Ms. Ledger, if you just state your name again for the record, and we'll get Representative Joachim's question for
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, Andrea Ledger.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ledger, could you explain again, maybe more clearly, the Supreme Court's ruling on the burdens imposed by women versus their purported benefits, mm-hmm. and maybe talk a little bit about the cost Wisconsin's faced in these challenges?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Ledger.
Apologies. Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, it was a three-part test that the court laid out, and so there were specific facts at issue in the text with the Texas HB2, but the court said that three things had to be met. The laws had to further a valid state interest, they had to confer benefits that outweighed burdens to women, and they had to be based on credible evidence. And I think in this case, we don't have any of those three parts of the test met. Related to the Wisconsin challenge, this was an admitting privileges requirement that Wisconsin had passed. And as I referenced earlier, the Texas law dealt with both an admitting privileges requirement and an ambulatory surgical center requirement. And the court said in the case of both that they did not meet this three-part test. Wisconsin had the admitting privileges law. It was immediately challenged following Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. I'm sure that the state had its own legal fees in terms of attorney general costs. I don't know if there was outside counsel involved. But they also eventually came to a settlement with Planned Parenthood and other providers in Wisconsin for $1.6 million in legal fees based on that undue burden standard.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll. Ms. Ledger, can you briefly touch on, too, the credible evidence of there being an issue? It just seems like this is something in search of something that hasn't happened here in Minnesota. So can you maybe touch on the credible evidence piece?
Ms. Ledger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, abortion is extremely safe. And there is not evidence, there was not evidence that the Supreme Court reviewed, there was not evidence in the Texas lower court decisions, and there is not evidence in Minnesota that abortion is unsafe, that clinics are somehow dangerous. Abortion is, especially in the first trimester, is very comparable to a D&C that women receive after a miscarriage. So this is a common procedure, and it's also extremely safe.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up. Representative Halverson, followed by Representative Mason.
Thank you. My first question would be for Ms. Ledger with regard to some of the statements that we heard from Representative Pugh. There was kind of a description of a dark and seedy path to receiving an abortion in Minnesota, and I understand that all of our clinics are licensed and regulated by the Department of Health. Is the name of a physician somehow withheld from a patient?
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I'm not aware of names of doctors being withheld from patients. I would note that the ambulatory surgical center requirements at issue here in Chapter 4675 of the administrative rules, they cover things like general maintenance, mechanical and electrical systems, emergency electrical service, air conditioning, heating and ventilation, filter efficiency, ducts, lining and ducts, exhaust systems. These are really about building maintenance requirements, and that's where the cost for clinics comes in. In a previous committee, Representative Olson from Duluth mentioned that she had toured the Duluth facility, that it's extremely clean, that it's extremely well-staffed, and I think that's true of the five abortion clinics in Minnesota.
Representative Halverson, follow-up?
Actually, a different question for Ms. Rao. With regard to your statement that you don't think the Duluth Clinic is at risk, how many clinics in Texas closed after their Texas law was put into place?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I know that it was a number of them. But I will say that the waiver that I talked about was not allowed in Texas. In regards to abortion facilities. So as previously stated, and also I think could impact a court decision, that is a very different situation than what we have.
Representative Halverson, follow-up.
I found the number here in terms of the number of clinics that closed in Texas. It was 56% of clinics were closed in Texas. That's not a small number. And so to dismiss the risk of closure that we are hearing from the Duluth Clinic, I think is unfair and irresponsible when we look at the number of women who get a variety of healthcare services from that particular clinic. And so I would really urge Ms. Rao to listen to what we're hearing from that clinic up in Duluth. The other marker I think that's significant with regard to the number of clinics that closed was the number of self-induced abortions that were happening in the state of Texas after that happened. And that really speaks to the fact that you can reduce services all you want. It doesn't reduce the demand. Women who seek self-induced abortions or who would perhaps go to an unlicensed or unregulated provider in some way are really at risk. That's taking us back to the dark ages, which I think Representative Pugh really alluded to. There was a dark age where you didn't know your provider. There was a dark age where women were dying in great numbers from unregulated procedures or from self-induced abortion. And they're thinking in Texas that between 100,000 to a quarter of a million women in Texas attempted self-induced abortions. Now that is a women's safety issue. That is quantifiable. and that is measurable. And so if you want to send women back to the alleys, and if you want to send women to death, that's what this does. There's clear evidence to show that. It doesn't make women safer, and to say that it does is disingenuous. I think there's a lot of ways we could work together to make women safer and to make the need for abortion less prevalent. There's a lot of evidence to that, including the access to contraception. I don't see this in this bill, so we have some problems with this bill.
Ms. Rao, that statement was directed to you, and certainly in keeping with our question statements and response, I'm going to give you a chance to respond this morning as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson. I agree that there are a number of ways that we can work together to make sure that women are safe and also to reduce the number of abortions that happen in Minnesota. We do disagree on this particular piece of legislation. I can assure you that our intent is the safety of women and making sure that women who go in to have abortions are doing so in a safe place. I have not at any point said that the facilities in Minnesota are dirty or decrepit like the one in Pennsylvania. I just want to make sure that never does happen in Minnesota, and that's the purpose of this legislation.
Our next member question comes from Representative Mason, and then another follow-up by Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm going to address this to Representative Keel. We have a number of letters in our packet opposing this, and certainly from the Commissioner of the Department of Health. And the one that I think is particularly important, and this is where I'm trying to figure out where your information is coming from, it's the Minnesota section of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And there's one sentence: there is currently no medical or ethical basis for this legislation. So where are you getting your information for this bill?
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, the question is, we want to make sure that we never find or find out that we have women threatened or to have any challenges with their health. And so by asking for licensure similar to the same as outpatient surgical center is all we're asking for. Why they're questioning it, nobody's come to my office and talked to me about it. We're just asking to make sure that women are assured that when they go into an outpatient surgical center or a abortion facility, that they are assured that they will get the care they need and it will be safe.
Representative Mason, follow up.
It's just the fact that they're the people that really seem to be working in this area and that I guess have more credibility are opposing this legislation. So this seems mainly to me to be an attack on women's health care. Thank you.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I promise after this I'm done. I just wanted to correct something that we heard earlier about the informed consent law. It's under Section 144.651. It's called the Health Care Bill of Rights, and under that Subdivision 7, it's required that a physician's identity is given to the patient. So earlier you had mentioned that the patient might not even know who performed the procedure. That's incorrect.
Ms. Rahal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquim, what I was referring to is our Woman's Right to Know Law, which was passed by the legislature a little more than a decade ago, and I had worked on that legislation as well. And when we were working to pass that, it included a provision that made sure that a patient was informed of the name of her doctor at least 24 hours before the procedure, so that if she wished to, she could look into their background, make sure they were licensed, see if there were any complaints, anything like that. And we ended up having to take that portion out of the legislation in order for it to become law, because it became such a distraction in the committee process, because those that opposed the Woman's Right to Know legislation simply constantly made amendments, offered amendments to remove that, and accused those who were wanted that information in there of simply wanting to know the name of the doctor so that there could be some kind of violent acts done. And so that provision is not included in the Woman's Right to Know Law, and that's what I was referring to.
Representative Joaquin, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rao, I am not familiar with that legislation, but our current statute says a patient is told who their doctor is, and you had mentioned that the woman might not even know. They may not know 24 hours ahead of time, but they do know who performed the procedure. Thank you.
Seeing no other member questions at this time, Representative Keel, I will renew my motion that House File H-12 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. I'll give you the final word before we do that.
I thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will make this short and sweet. I think that this is important legislation to give women what they deserve, the safety and the assurance that when they seek whatever health care they're looking for in a facility, that they are assured that it is licensed and prepared for them. And thank you. I ask you to support this amendment.
Again, I will renew my motion that House File 812 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The next three bills that we have on the agenda today, members, are going to be election-related bills. We are going to hear them and lay them over for possible inclusion in the 2017 Elections Omnibus Bill, should there be one coming from this committee. And Representative, you have all three bills today. And is there one in particular that you'd like to take in the order on this? They are all your bills. We do have some multiple testifiers on the different bills. I'll defer to you as to what's most convenient for you, the bill author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll take House File 2039, since I see that we have quite a few testifiers, and this bill will definitely require more conversations. So I'd like to start with that, please.
All right. I will move House File 2039 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Elections Omnibus Bill, should there be one. Representative Pugh, you'll go ahead and begin with the presentation of the bill this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I would like to inform everyone that I do have a DE amendment, and I just noticed that it was not in my packet, but it was enclosed in one of my other bills packets.
And so, Representative Pugh, you are exactly right. Members, if you'll locate your packets, House File 2271, right behind that you will see the DE1 amendment. Again, that's 2271. You'll find the 2039 DE1 amendment. So I just ask you to take that out. And this is Representative Pugh is referring to when she says she has an author's amendment. Has everyone been able to locate that? Representative Pugh, we will go ahead and move the DE amendment to House File 2039. Representative Nelson.
I request a roll call on the DE1 amendment.
Representative Nelson requests a roll call on the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author chooses. That's something we usually do, but certainly within the rights of a member. So with that, the clerk will take the roll on the DE amendment. All those in favor of the DE amendment to get the bill in order that the author wishes, the roll call being asked, the clerk will take the roll.
That's what he was saying earlier.
O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Pugh?
Aye.
Bliss?
Yes.
Fenton?
Yes.
Halverson?
No.
Jessup?
Yes.
Mason?
No.
Nash?
Yep.
Nelson?
No.
Peterson?
Aye.
Quam?
Yes.
Samstead?
No.
Samstead, is that one no, please?
Swierczynski?
Yes.
Tice?
Yes.
West?
Yes.
Joaquin?
No.
There being 11 ayes and 5 nays, the motion does prevail. The DE1 amendment is adopted to get the bill in the order that the author wishes. Representative Pugh will proceed with
the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would like at this time to ask Mr. Gehring for a point of clarification. I believe I may need to make one slight oral amendment. I noticed that in Section 5, it does not apply. Section 5, I'll go there. Does not apply to people who are marked challenged on the roster. And so a simple oral amendment would remedy that. So on line 5.15, if I could make the word sections, the word section, plural, and if I could add 201.15, 201.155, 201.1, I believe it's 1157, and 201.158. My apologies, Mr. Chair.
Karen, can you help us with that, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, so the cross-reference that's currently on 5.15 to Section 201.061, Subdivision 4, Clause 2, is a reference to that list of sections. So I think what you're trying to do is already included the way the amendment is drafted.
Very, very good. That's why I needed Mr. Gehring. Thank you. So then it's not necessary?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I guess... unless you have an intent to do something that's different than what's in what you see in Section 1 of the bill, it sounds like your oral amendment probably is not necessary.
Perfect.
And Mr. Gehring, that's because the for members' clarification on line 1.12, if I'm understanding you correctly, she's recited those that she wanted in her oral amendment, but because it's covered within the scope of this, it, when it refers to sections, we're okay. Is that what I'm understanding?
Mr. Chair, so on 5.15 of the DE1 amendment, the cross-reference there is cross-referencing the list that's on 1.12.
Very good. Very good. So Representative Pugh does not look like we need to have that.
Very good.
So if you'll again proceed with your bill as amended.
Yes. So once again, good morning, members. And so I believe that my bill will significantly increase election integrity in Minnesota. It includes policy that treats all voters the same while disenfranchising no one. In preparing for this bill hearing, I attended a hearing, the hearing, of the Senate Omnibus Bill, House or Senate File 514. Which was authored by Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, who was elected to the office of Secretary of State for 8 years. I listened to the audio tape of Senate File 771, which was the mate to my original bill, House File 2039, twice. I reviewed the Secretary of State's letter of opposition to Senate File 771, and I see that we just received another one here, which I haven't had time to read yet. My apologies, Chairman and members. I have quite a bit of a cold, and I may have taken the NyQuil instead of the DayQuil, so I'm struggling focusing on the words on my page, so I'm going to do the best I can. In addition to that, I met with Ms. Strother of the Secretary of State's office and Mr. Hussey of the ACLU. And then I made changes to my bill over the weekend, and hence the DE. I changed the effective date. I added the safe at home language, which I heard from concerns surfaced in the Senate. And I added a simple procedure by which every challenged person could, in fact, cast a vote on Election Day. To summarize my bill, Section 1 directs the Secretary of State to provide county auditors with a list of people who have been determined to be ineligible to vote based on felony conviction, mental incompetence, or lack of citizenship. It then directs the election judge assigned to the Election Day Registration, EDR, to review the list when registering people to vote on Election Day. If someone listed as ineligible insists they are eligible, the election judge must allow them to vote with a challenge status. So the challenge process is outlined in Section 5. Section 2 of my bill simply requires the head election judge to keep a record of the people who registered to vote with a challenge status and to distribute that information to the county auditor and canvassing board. Section 3 of my bill requires the public information lists of registered voters to include registered voters who are marked challenged. This would make that information public. Section 4, I'll just mention that in listening to the tapes of Senator Kiffmeyer presenting, I can't recall if it was the omnibus bill or if it was her Senate file itself, she stated in her testimony that, in fact, this information was at one time public. So Section 4 requires absentee ballot registrations to be verified against the same list created in Section 1. And finally, in Section 5, establishes the process for accepting or rejecting a challenged ballot. The process is modeled after Wisconsin, my home state. Like Minnesota, Wisconsin allows for same-day registration. But before registering someone, an election judge in Wisconsin must review a list of felons provided by the Department of Corrections. If there is a match and the individual insists on voting, the judge writes challenged on the ballot and the voter's identification number. Likewise, this bill requires election judges to mark a ballot challenged. The canvassing board must then review any ballot marked challenged before they officially certify the election results. The problem and opportunity our election system, as I see it here in Minnesota, is to ensure that we are in balance in creating access to vote with the integrity of the vote. And I believe my bill will help strike that perfect balance. As state law is currently applied, people who have been officially designated as ineligible to vote by a court order are allowed to vote through same-day registration without any review of their actual eligibility to vote. In fact, state law currently appears, application of state law currently appears unconstitutional to me. As I take a look at my constitution, which has a rubber band around it, and I had to ask my legislative assistant to blow up the font size because I need a new prescription and I'm literally having a hard time reading. Article 7, Section 1 states, the following persons shall not be permitted, be entitled or permitted to vote at any election in this state: a person who has been convicted of a felony unless restored to civil rights, a person under guardianship, or a person who is insane or mentally incompetent. So that's Article 7, Section 1 of the Minnesota Constitution. This also is true for people who are identified as ineligible non-citizens by the Department of Public Safety, the State Court Administrator, Department of Corrections, and the Department of Public Safety. All provide regular reports listing ineligible voters to the Office of the Secretary of State. Unlike nearly every state in the country, this information is not used to check a registrant's eligibility before they vote. As a result, the current registration process creates the potential for felons to determine, and for felons, those determined to be mentally incompetent and non-citizens, to register and vote. Every ineligible vote from one of these individuals cancels out and disenfranchises the vote of an eligible voter. Equally as troubling, the ineligible voters put themselves at serious risk for a further criminal prosecution. A felon on probation who may have thought they were finally free may find themselves charged with another felony for voting. That's what recently happened to three felons in Kandy, Ohio County. Mr. Chairman, I believe this bill may be the solution to this problem and an opportunity for Minnesota. This issue could be mitigated if election judges assigned to same-day registration were given a list of ineligible voters from the Secretary of State. The Office of the Secretary of State already receives lists and checks them against registered voters. It just makes common sense to me that the same list should be checked against someone registering to vote on Election Day before their vote counts. And that's what my bill aims to accomplish. What I'd really like to see, although it's not prescribed in this bill, is the Secretary of State's office maybe working in conjunction with the county auditors to completely clean up our voter registration rolls so that the public and the state, you know, that and to share with the state, this is another something I really heard repeatedly in the testimony, that there are members of the public that aren't aware that the state of Minnesota is collecting this information on them. It's all law that they can collect this information, but it's concerning to me that Minnesotans don't know that this information is being collected. So I just see that as another opportunity. But given the effective date of my bill, which is January 1st, 2018, I'm confident that a significant degree of government transparency and accountability could occur before that date. I share Secretary of State Simon's vision for ensuring rigorous safety measures are in place, and that's a quote, and that Minnesota can have confidence in our election integrity, in the integrity of our system. So I believe my bill, House File 2039, will be a step in the right direction to ensuring that that happens. And so, Mr. Chair, I see that we have a list of testifiers. I know that the Secretary is here, as are members of his staff. I'm assuming that there may be others here, the ACLU, to testify as they did in the Senate against my bill. So if I could start there, I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pugh.
Give my voice a break.
I will ask Secretary Simon to come up, and then Mr. Haas from the ACLU, if you want to make your way up as well, we'll get your testimony. Secretary Simon, welcome to the committee. Appreciate having you here with us today. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Secretary of State. Representative Pugh, I know what you're going through here with the big Will Knight bill. I just got my voice back a couple days ago. You may recall last time I was before you, it was considerably worse, so you won't have to suffer through that. So.
Much.
I'm with you.
Secretary, we don't want you to tax your voice today as well, so brevity is always important.
It always. right, especially in this circumstance. I will be.
Concerned for your health, Mr. Secretary.
Always appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. And I do want to start by seriously thanking Representative Pugh. I really appreciate her openness. I appreciate her outreach. And what seems to me to be a sincere desire on her part to sort of get to yes here. But I did want to outline some of the concerns that I and my office still have with the bill. You have a letter before you, and in the interest of brevity, among other things, I won't just repeat what's in that letter. You can read for yourself. You know, originally House File 2039 was really focused on the data sharing issue, and the first part of the letter does address that issue. And I won't go over all of it except to say that it is true that voters right now don't know that we have a lot of this information on them, and to make it public, I think, would create maybe a troubling precedent, particularly in light of the Tennyson warnings that our office and others already give to voters, basically promising them that the only thing that will be released on them is a certain segment. And what would happen if this were to become law is we would go beyond that. Some of the information naturally is inaccurate or out of date, simply because we're only as good and fresh as the information that we get from various state agencies, as you'll see in that letter. And then finally, you know, I think if you look at the purpose of the public information list, its initial purpose is always to facilitate political campaigns and parties to communicate with registered voters. I'm not so sure that releasing this extra and added and new information would do that. But I really want to devote what little time I have, members, to just voice some caution about Section 5 of the bill. And this was only readily available to us and the rest of the public yesterday afternoon with the DE amendment. It wasn't part of the original bill. But this really does impose the first ever in state history, we think, provisional ballot or provisional ballot-like scheme in Minnesota. And just a quick background on that, members. As part of the 2002 Help America Vote Act, or HAVA for short, you've heard that acronym perhaps in this committee, Congress required many states, not all, but many, to impose provisional balloting. But crucially, the reason that Congress did that on a bipartisan basis was that provisional balloting in Minnesota was exempt from that requirement because we at the time and still have same-day voter registration. That's why we don't have it. But, Mr. Chair, the reason for provisional balloting in that context was as a stopgap and safeguard to the voter. And the reason it was important in the context of HAVA was you can imagine in most states, not Minnesota, but in most states where you don't have same-day voter registration, if you don't register by 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the election, you're out of luck. It doesn't matter that you didn't know or you forgot or you misunderstood the law. You're out of luck. And imagine a situation in one of those states, and many of you have maybe spent some time or have come from states like that. If you show up and you're convinced that you were registered, maybe you signed on someone's clipboard on a street corner or for whatever reason you think you're registered, and you don't appear on the list when you walk into your polling place. In Minnesota, that's not an issue because you can just register right there on game day, so to speak. But in those other 36 states, you can't. So what Congress said is, look, you might think you're on the list, and maybe you were on the list, but let's wait and see if we can clear this up once you vote provisionally, and then we'll clear all this up within a few days. That's why provisional balloting was put in place. So it wasn't meant at the time for states like Minnesota where you can clear it up right there by registering to vote. And so I think for the first time, what we would be doing in Minnesota, which I think justifies a lot more discussion than you'll likely have time for in this committee, what we'll be doing is for the first time creating sort of a maybe pile. There's the yes, you can vote, the no, you can't vote, and the maybe you can vote. Now, we've never done that in Minnesota. It doesn't mean it's not worth talking about just because we haven't done it, but we haven't ever done that in Minnesota. And it's something that I think you'll find in the letter spells this out, so I won't repeat it, is costly. I think it's burdensome. You're going to hear from some folks here today from the county levels. They're folks really on the front line. I think it will provide some unnecessary impediments, I think. I think doing that is problematic, particularly when you pair it with this idea of marking someone's ballot, not the envelope, but the ballot itself as challenge. The additional part of this that differs from Senator Kiffmeyer's bill and other provisional balloting ideas out there is most provisional balloting ideas, at least Senator Kiffmeyer's bill, the one that's alive in the Senate, would say that you vote provisionally and then within a week the voter would have to go to his or her county auditor's office and make certain proofs or showings to demonstrate their eligibility. What this bill, as I understand it, would do is not have the voter do that, but somehow leave it to counties and canvassing boards. And I don't see anything at this point that would give the voter an opportunity to weigh in and say, hey, I'm John J. Jones, not John K. Jones of the same birth year who's a felon. Or, yes, I wasn't a citizen last month or 6 weeks ago when this list was made, but I am a citizen now. Or, I am 18 years old now. You may have me on a list of 17-year-olds, but I am 18. I don't see any place, at least in the current legislation, unless I'm misreading it, that gives the voter the opportunity to really prove that up, either in person at a county auditor's office or really anywhere. It's sort of given over to county administrators, and then the election folks sort of make a decision to resolve that. So I just want to say I appreciate Representative Pugh's creative thinking behind these issues. I think she wants what I want and what we all want, and I very much appreciate that. I think Minnesotans are proud of our election system, but before we go down this road, which is a substantial change from what we've done since statehood, I think we need some more dialogue, some more discussion. And as the bill stands now, I can't support it. Of course, I don't have a vote. You do. Thanks for your time and attention, and I'm happy to stand for questions will come up after.
Yeah, Mr. Secretary, we do have a number of member questions that have been compiling during the testimony. We're going to start with Representative Quam, followed by Representative Nelson. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary, you mentioned that frankly, 97% of the people that live in the United States live where there's provisional ballots. There's also a state that has same-day registration that has a provisional ballot for challenge. So, you know, one aspect of provisional ballot is that everyone gets to cast a ballot. The other aspect is voter integrity, which prevents the commingling of a ballot until it's, if it's been challenged or provisional, from being counted. And as we saw with a sort of a close race for state, you know, that in the state with you know, Senate race, was it
2005?
Right. I think everybody remembers that, you know, where ballots were found in trunks and there were just a few hundred votes total difference, and that there were over 1,000 people that were not eligible to vote that did vote, and many of those were brought to trial and some were convicted, that if we had this, we maybe could have prevented that issue and had a little bit more integrity and reassurance about the you know, outcome of that election. And, you know, frankly, I'm just disappointed that Minnesota is still one of the three states that have a exemption from provisional ballots from HAVA, where, you know, Massachusetts, California, Washington, you know, so I can go on and on and on with the number of states that actually are capable of having a provisional ballot, having that guarantee that everybody that enters gets to cast a ballot, but also the guarantee that we have some type of prevention from fraud. I remember in the recent past there being a election in southeastern Minnesota which was decided by about a dozen ballots, and an election judge took 17 spoiled ballots home and destroyed them. And, you know, there was quite a bit of concern about the integrity there. You know, frankly, I just wish the Secretary of State's office would help us to be fully compliant with HAVA, as another state with same-day registration is, by having provisional ballots. But I understand that that might be a step too far for this committee, so that at least we can have the increased assurance and integrity that this bill provides. And I believe it's very similar to the process in another state, so that, you know, some of the issues you could learn and avoid in implementing it. So I'm just, I guess, more imploring the Secretary of State to help in the process of HAVA compliance as opposed to a question.
Mr. Secretary, in response to Representative Kwan. Representative Nelson, followed by Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. I guess I have concerns about this bill, and before the amendment was put on, and I had even more concerns about this bill once with the amendment, which is why I asked to have it roll called. And some of my concern is the Section 5 that's in the Delete All Amendment, that the way challenges and are handled at the polling place and how they'd be handled later on when those returns are canvassed. Because if in my district, and I've said this before, but in my district one year when I door knocked seven Mike Nelsons in my district, me being the eighth, and if one of those Mike Nelsons was a challenge voter, no Mike Nelsons ever had a felony conviction against them, so I'm sure that wasn't the case, would be the case. But if one of them was challenged, was on a list of challenged voters, I could be challenged and have to then, according to this, mark my ballot, sign it in some way to identify it as my ballot. Later on when it's canvassed, they would know how I voted. Because when it comes out, canvassing procedures, my understanding, Secretary Simon, is that those are open public meetings that anyone can witness. So my ballot would be pulled out. There was Mike Nelson's ballot challenged. It's Mike Nelson's. This is how Mike Nelson voted. And if I guess my better judgment, voted for a Republican for some point, everyone would know that I voted for a Republican, and I could be ostracized in my community. This is a problem I have with this section, is that we are taking away the secrecy of the ballot from these challenged voters, and that's very troubling to me. So, Representative Simon, am I correct in saying that this is an open procedure, and you could identify a person voting that they are the ones that voted, and you could then therefore identify how they voted?
Although you were referred to as Representative Simon, I think you got a little bit of a promotion, so we will ask Secretary Simon to respond.
Thanks for the promotion, Representative Simon.
Perhaps not a promotion, a different assignment. Proceed.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, yes, canvases are open. So if a ballot is marked, as they are in recounts and other circumstances, so if the ballot, as opposed to a ballot envelope, is marked, then yes, it would be possible to determine who voted for whom.
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, this is probably the most troubling part of this. There's a lot of other parts of this that are troubling. One is that we're changing data laws. So this bill, if this became part of our election bill, it would make it difficult for this bill to move forward, and then would have to go to the Data Practices Committee. So I'm going to, for that reason, I'm going to oppose the bill as amended.
Representative Pugh would like to make a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that the language specifically calls for simply the notation of the word challenged and then the unique identifying number that every voter has. You know, just like right now, I have 10 pages of shrunk down, but a voter registration. And there's a unique identifying number that is assigned to every that it would only be the word challenged and the unique identifying number that would be on the ballot, so that those ballots would be compiled at the end of the night all in one envelope, all of the challenged ballots. And so there isn't an envelope. My bill doesn't call for provisional balloting, nothing like that. So I just wanted to clarify that. I have other ideas relative to the list and Representative Nelson's bill. I mean, my bill is being laid over for possible consideration. It's definitely a work in progress, but I am looking forward to ironing out some of these things, and there are ideas to resolve that.
Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I guess the idea about the unique identifying number, it's my understanding that unique identifying number is public data also. So again, it would take long, wouldn't be difficult for someone to figure that out. Plus, if a person is registering on election day, they don't get that unique identifying number until such time as that is entered in the computer system, is my understanding. And I see the secretary nodding his head over there. And I guess the question I have is another question I have that brings to mind is that if a person comes to election and they're not on this list that we've created, that Mike Nelson is going to be challenged because there's one Mike Nelson that lives in Brooklyn Park, might be a felon and not ineligible to vote. Of course, that's never going to happen. No Mike Nelson would ever have a felony.
That was established earlier, Mr. Representative.
Yeah. But say one of the election judges or somebody, a person there challenged a person and said, they're not eligible to vote. No, I'm going to go through the procedures, but I'm not on this list. How would Section 5 apply to that person? I guess the question would be to Representative Pugh.
We will go to the bill author, Representative Pugh.
I'm very sorry. I may need. Can you repeat the question in just a very tight? I mean, I'm having a hard time focusing on everything.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, what if a person is challenged by somebody? You know, we get a person at polling place. Can challenge people coming and saying that person's not eligible, that person's not eligible. They may not be on this list that we've created. How does Section 5 apply to that person? Would Section 5 apply to that person? How do I identify that person and their ability to file a provisional ballot? Because these are provisional ballots by any other name. We're creating a provisional balloting system, which is what we don't have currently in Minnesota, and you can say it's not, but it is, because you're having to identify it.
Representative Pugh, and then I do have other testifiers.
Representative Nelson, Representative
Nelson. And we do have other testifiers. So
yes, and so I did discuss this as I was drafting this with Mr. Gehring, and I know that we discussed that there are obviously challenges that can occur from a poll challenger or an election judge, having served as both in the past. I would like to ask Mr. Gehring if there's language here that addresses that issue, or if that is a matter that would need to, would require further language.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, so the language that I would point to is on 5.13 to 5.15. So this is what you were talking about with your possible oral amendment earlier. So this section for challenge voters only applies to those voters who are registering same day whose name appears on the list created by the Secretary of State. So if you're being challenged by another person in the polling place or for another reason, then you would follow the existing challenge process and you wouldn't do this.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring.
Representative Halverson, followed by Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have to say I feel Representative Nelson's pain with having a common name. I was once a Nelson as well. And
sorry to hear that.
Upgraded to a much more exotic Halverson. I think that we all need to take our vitamin C in this committee. I wanted to ask the Secretary, or perhaps if Ms. Strother wants to serve as a voice, a little bit more about the actual procedure for same-day registration, the background checks that go on. I know we did a lot of work a few years ago to upgrade our systems so that we have nearly just-in-time information about voters. And so I often hear the statement that you can just walk into any polling place on election day and cast your ballot. And having registered same day, thankfully, when I was a college student, the first time I voted, I was able to register same day. And that was not the procedure. I had to prove, and I remember it was a long time ago, but I remember proving who I was, where I lived. In fact, I had to go back home and get a different utility bill to prove who I was, and then those things are checked on the other end, so we know if people are committing a felony by voting fraudulently. So are you able to address kind of what the actual procedure is, because it's not the Wild West that we're often allowed to claim?
Ms. Struthers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Julie Strother with the Secretary of State's office. I will do my best to answer the first part of that, and Secretary Simon can jump in if I am missing anything. But same-day registration, like you mentioned, you need to prove you are who you say you are and you live where you say you live through the acceptable list of proofs. You also need to swear under oath and penalty of perjury that you are eligible to vote. Following Election Day, we run all of those same-day registrations when they're entered to the system through the checks that everyone is run through, through driver and vehicle services, data on citizenship, the courts, the Department of Corrections. We also have the ERIC database that we run registrations through to update registrations. So they do get all of those checks in addition to the additional check in person on Election Day, where they have to show those proofs of registration to an election judge and swear under oath that they're eligible to vote. Does that answer your first question? And so the second question, which was, I think I may hand off to Secretary Simon, not the procedures, but the question about, you had a question about how many people have been convicted of this. Was there a question about, did I miss that? Okay, never mind. Did that answer your question? I apologize.
Representative Halverson, follow up.
Mr. Chair, it did, and with regard to the number, I don't know if you came forward with any questionable registrations that you've come across and how those have been handled. It might be helpful to know what kind of numbers we're looking at. Is it thousands? Is it tens? Is it less than that?
Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I can tell you the current data as of when I left my office this morning to go to this hearing. So you may know that county attorneys, prosecutors, are required to share with us, even when they conclude an investigation relating to the registration or voter fraud. So that's a requirement. So we're always going to hear about it. And I think the count, Ms. Strother, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was 9 counties for a total of 16 people so far. Now, there may be others that come in the door, of course, but right now we're talking about 9 counties, 16 people that have risen to the level of an investigation that may culminate with a charge or a prosecution.
Representative Halverson.
And to
put that in perspective, we had just shy of 3 million voters.
Okay.
2,968,000, I think, and change. So just shy of 3 million voters.
Okay. And those 16 are not yet prosecuted, so there might not be charges based on additional information that prosecutors find out, which is interesting. So we would essentially put millions of voters' ballots on the line for a potential 16, which it sounds like we're finding. So I think that the risk of disenfranchising Minnesota voters for what is clearly a very secure system is upsetting. I would lose my mind if I went to vote and was told my vote was not going to count that day. It is so fundamentally important to the values that we hold in our democracy that I would really look hard at presuming that everybody who registered same day somehow is presumed to be a challenged voter, because that is a dangerous precedent, I believe.
Members of the committee, just a little update here. We've got about 12 minutes left, and we have a number of testifiers and member questions yet. So we will be reconvening tonight at 7:30 or the call of the chair to finish this bill and the other two bills that we have on the agenda in room 300 South. So you want to plan accordingly for that this evening. 7:30 or the call of the chair, room 300 South. Representative Joachim, to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this question might be for Secretary of State Simon. You briefly went over why provisional ballots were originally put into place, and my understanding from your testimony, and correct me if I'm wrong, is most provisional balloting was there to make sure that people could pursue their right to vote in states where same-day registration wasn't available, and they'd come into the polling place convinced they'd already registered, their name was on the list. So it gave them the opportunity to cast that ballot and then come back with information proving who they were. Is that accurate?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim. Yes, correct.
Representative Pugh, I apologize. Before I went to Representative Joachim, you did have a comment
on the
previous.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Representative Joachim is going to put you on hold for just a second.
Yes, I appreciate that. I just wanted to correct the record. We are not talking about provisional ballots, Representative Halverson. We are not going to be disenfranchising anyone. Anyone who presents to vote on Election Day will vote on Election Day. The only individuals that will be experiencing this procedure, and it's just the stamping of the ballot is challenged with the their unique identifying number, as every voter has, will be those that appear on the list that the Secretary of State's office has provided. So no one else will.
Now, Representative Nelson, is this to the response?
It's to the response, yes.
Okay. And Representative Joachim also has questions. And again, given the shortness of the time, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put, again, we're against the clock, and I would like to be accommodated to the members of the public who might not be able to be here with us this evening, and given the number of the other people who are looking to testify on the matter. If it's all right with the two of you, I'd like to just see if there's any public input so that the public might not be inconvenienced of having to come back this evening.
Okay.
Members will be coming back, I'm sure. Representative Joachim?
I understand that, Mr. Chair, but I think Representative Nelson has something very specific to what was just said, and I have just one follow-up for Secretary of Senate.
Then what I am going to do before I take other testifiers is go to the public, because I do want to give them the chance. Many of them may have taken time off to be here with us today, and to ask them to come back this evening might be a little bit of a hard step. So Representative Nelson, and then I will turn it back to Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, just that Section 5, as has been described here, the people that are going to have to identify that, these are the people that are registering on Election Day. And so, therefore, as the Secretary Steinman said, they won't have a unique identifying number. They won't have a voter ID number that to put on the ballot. So I guess my understanding then would be they'd have to write their name on the ballot to identify that this is the person, this is who I am.
and when that ballot goes in the box, because they won't have that identifying number ahead of time because they haven't registered yet.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that is not my intent at all. No one will write their name on the list. My assumption, and I could be wrong, and I'd already made myself a note to follow up on this, is either something that needs to become a part of the legislation should this be included in the bill. But as I showed, every you know, voter registration roll has the unique identifying number. And my assumption would be that there could be the blank sheets where individuals could be registering, and then they have there's a unique identifying number for each precinct, each of the 4,000-some precincts. So I do think that I was even thinking it could just be a little sticker at the end. It could just go right on that ballot. There's only a number and the word challenged. So this, there will be no one's name on the ballot.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. Representative Pugh, we're calling this provisional balloting because it really is, and a rose by any other name would smell as sweet or stinky in this case, but with provisional balloting in other states, and maybe Secretary of State can correct me if I'm wrong, in other states, when a person does a provisional ballot, they're told that it's a provisional ballot, and they have a chance to come back within a week and prove. With this case, I know they're told and it's noted, but is there any recourse for that person to be able to come back and prove? Because I don't see that in the bill.
Representative Pugh.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, that two points. That is one of the issues that I have noted, that there does not appear to be language, although maybe, again, I might like to ask Mr. Gehring if I'm incorrect. I made myself a note that that would be an opportunity to clean up the language.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, on 5.26 and 5.27, it allows the canvassing board to receive any other relevant information or testimony, which presumably could include testimony from the voter.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And then, Representative Joachim, what was the second I was just going to make a point that Wisconsin has provisional balloting, which is the envelope and that whole process, and then they have this procedure. This is not provisional balloting. You could call it that, but I am not, and I won't. This is not provisional balloting. That ballot is going right in with everyone else's, and no one will be disenfranchised.
Is there any member of the public who is here this afternoon who will not be able to come back this evening to provide testimony on the matter before the committee on House File 2039 as amended? Again, I do want to be respectful of the members of the public. Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Joachim, did you also have a follow-up that you wanted to do? I saw you grabbing toward the mic when Representative Pugh, or maybe that's just a natural reaction, I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and actually, Representative Pugh, I just want to make sure that if we're going to put this provisional balloting in place, that when you tell people that the ballot's going to be challenged, that they're given the information on how to respond, because having an ERISA statute and then education of the voter to be able to uphold the right to vote is two different things. So I get a little nervous that this is a DE, that we're kind of throwing this at the last minute and not having a lot of testimony in it when it substantially changes the way we vote in Minnesota. So I look forward to 7:30 at night.
Mr. Haas, I said you would be next, so we'll give you the chance to proceed and provide your testimony. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Go state your name, who you represent, proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Pugh. My name is Mark Haase, and I represent the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I'll keep this very brief. The ACLU of Minnesota has a couple of areas of concern regarding this legislation. One is the information list, the public information list, which you've already heard quite a bit about. As you probably know, the ACLU is a very strong proponent of keeping private citizen information private. And as you've also heard, there's already a lot of information that's provided to the public through the voting system and the public information list. The information that would be added to that regarding challenges and reasons for challenge makes that even more concerning, and particularly around the accuracy, and I'm not able to speak too much to some of the other areas of potential challenge, but I do have quite a bit of experience in the criminal records area. And I've worked with people in that system, both impacted by it and those and professionals working on it. And there have been many instances where the records are not the same at the courts as they are at the BCA. Somebody may be told by their probation officer even that they can vote. I've seen criminal records that are attributed to somebody else other than that person. And, you know, ideally the system would tell us who can't vote on the day they go to vote accurately, but that is not, we're probably never going to get there. Hopefully we can get closer, and I think Representative Pugh is working to make that happen as well. But given that, you know, there still is a lot of challenges there, using that information, making it public, is of concern, as is, you know, and that's information that can be damaging to somebody, you know, if they're inaccurately put on another list that they have a felony conviction. The other question we have about that is, you know, concern is how would that information be used? Who's going to use it and for what purpose? Would somebody take that information and call the person and inquire about their status? You know, I don't think any of you would want that happening, and we wouldn't want that to happen either. And then our other area of concern is with also the challenge process in Section 5. You know, Minnesota has had a self-certification process since the 1880s. As you've already heard, if somebody takes that oath and perjures himself, that's a new felony. We think that's a strong protection there. And just, you know, in summation, it's also a strong principle of the ACLU that the right to vote, which is a right, it's also a privilege, but it's also a right. Sometimes things are both, is one of the most fundamental rights in our government. It's enshrined in our system of government. And we all know that if government is not held accountable to the people, then all the other rights can be eroded and eventually taken away. So we ask that any steps you take in this respect are taken very carefully to protect that right. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Ms. Guise, and then we'll try to get Mr. Nelson in here as well. Oh, Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to extend the comment, and I wanted to thank Mr. Hussey for working with me. We exchanged, you know, quite an email thread and then met to discuss this. I am sensitive to felons' records, especially those which have been expunged. And my intent is to ensure that in some way that that data is protected, and we discuss that. Also, with regard to the challenge process, you know, I spoke with Senator Kiffmeyer this morning on my way in, and I hadn't before today reread this particular article and section of the Constitution. And it just seems to me that our current procedure right now, that we are, it's unconstitutional what we're doing right now. We're putting those who are mentally incapacitated in a position to self-certify. Does this make sense? It doesn't make sense to me. And felons as well. You know, they may have the example of Candy Ojai. So I'll just leave it at that. I'm concerned about what we're doing right now, and that's a part of the reason why, as I spoke with Mark the other day, why Senator Kiffmeyer put a July 1st date in her bill. I extended mine to January 1st of 2018 to give the Secretary of State's office a lot more time to really work to, you know, clean up the lists. So that's it, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Guise from Scott County, we'll have you. And then, Mr. Nelson, is your testimony going to be brief this morning, or did you want to wait till this evening when we reconvene?
It can be brief, but I can be back.
Well, then we'll take you as our last testifier, and then we will recess until this evening. And am I pronouncing your name correct, Guise? Ms. Guise, welcome. State your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony this morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, members of the committee. Where am I? Today's Tuesday. I should be at County Board. I apologize for that. My name is Cindy Geis. I am the Scott County Auditor Treasurer. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers today on this bill. I do want to start my testimony today just to thank Representative Pugh. I truly like the thought of, you know, making sure that the voter integrity is held at its utmost and to make sure that whatever we do and whatever legislation goes forward, whether it be this year, next year, or some other year, that it truly does meet all the criteria that we're all striving for. That being said, the bill in its current format doesn't meet that, and I will kind of call out from the county's perspective some of the anomalies that are hanging out there that we're still trying to address. And some of them really, I look at Representative Nelson and Halverson, and we had a voter named Carlson. And this voter Carlson, their name comes to us on every list. Every time we get a list from the Secretary of State, this person's name is on there saying that this person is a felon. Well, the first time we marked this person as a felon, they were mortified when they went to the polling location and they were challenged because they said that this person should be. They called voter called us after the fact, after the challenge was issued, and he passed and he was able to vote. But he said, how can you mark me as a challenged voter? I don't understand this. I have never, ever committed a felony. And he was claiming like a human rights and how dare we, and he was going to sue the county. Well, his name, as it was, some of the basic baseline information matched. We had to mark him as challenged. That's what we're tasked to do. However, with this provision, I am fearful that the counties will get sued. Somebody will take us to court and say, there's no way that you can turn around and say, absolutely not. You have to go through this process. Even though his vote is able to be cast, any type of identifying mark for him, I think, is going to not be taken lightly. Not only that, but I also serve on the canvassing board. Now, when all of the stuff comes back to the county, over the course of the next 3 days, we're auditing. We're making sure that all the numbers match, that all of these polling location summary statements all match, and that's really what we're trying to do and trying to get all that information done before the canvassing board is held, which is just days after the election closes. As a canvassing board member, I would have no idea whether what I'm looking at I should turn around that vote should be counted or that vote should not be counted. I don't have the data necessary. That the only time the information that goes is the stuff that the county attorney does through their investigative process and through the court action. So as far as the canvassing board, we're looking at a city administrator, myself, the court administrator or their designee, and in many cases we do get a designee. Nobody has any additional information at that point to make that judgment call. So that's kind of a challenge with just Section 5 and saying, hey, by the way, we do want to ensure the integrity and only the people who are eligible to vote do vote. I also have a question about when we're looking through this language saying, you know, from our election judge's perspective, they're going to get very confused. So if they're on this list, they go through this process. If they're on a different list, or if they're marked as challenged and they're a felon within the roster, then they don't have to have that. And I have very, very fearful that in each of these polling locations, different processes and procedures are going to take place because of the confusion of the election judges. We spend a ton of time training these election judges, and we do whatever we can to make sure that they understand what they're supposed to do in every situation. And I will guarantee you that they don't. Because they get there and someone goes on break and someone else fills in. You have a registration judge and then you have other judges. Of course, the registration judge doesn't have the ballots. They can't register a person and issue a ballot. So then they're going to have to give them something else to take to a different person to put on the ballot itself, whether it be an indication or a sticker or anything to that effect. Once that voter gets that ballot and they go to cast that ballot, these tabulators are going to kick it out every day of the week and twice on Sundays because it's going to be looked at as an extraneous mark and it's not going to be accepted. So now we're going to have a ballot that's going to get rejected from the tabulator and we're going to have to remake it or allow them to re-vote and say, well, don't put that note on there. We can't put challenged up here or down below. What are we going to do to get this ballot into the tabulator? We just don't have the mechanism today. Our tabulators are locked tight for any of those extraneous marks. So we have to be very careful. And I would never, ever, ever recommend putting a sticker on a ballot because if it gets jammed in that tabulator, now we're going to probably have to replace it. So we would prefer not to do that. We would like the funding to still come through the legislative process if it can come this year. But that being said, we do look at the anomaly and secrecy of the ballots. That's a huge concern for us. And one of the last things that I would like to say, and I appreciate you taking my testimony today, it's my anniversary, and I just shot my husband a text saying, oh, by the way, honey, guess what? You want to come to St. Paul for me? It could be date night to the legislature.
Do you know how to have fun?
He was less than enthused. He's like, thanks, but no thanks. How fast can you get home from work today? But anyway, I really want to say that we will continue to work with the representative and people from both parties to say we all want are striving for the same purpose, and however we get there is something that probably won't happen in this session, but let's take the time, let's do it right the first time without having to revisit it over and over again.
Ms. Geis, happy anniversary.
Well, thank you.
But stay right where you're at because we've got an anniversary present for you. Representative Joachim has a question.
Wow, Mr. Chair, now the bar is really high. Ms. Geis, thank you so much for coming and testifying, and this is a good example of why we have folks that do this, work in the trenches, and do this day in and day out so they understand all the processes we don't understand up here. And I do appreciate your goal of making sure our elections have integrity, and I agree with that goal. I just want to qualify one thing I heard you say to make sure I understand. Are you saying when the canvassing board meets, and if we were to put this law into place and you'd see the stamp of challenged with a voter ID number that may or may not be there, you wouldn't have enough information at the canvassing board to then try to figure out if that ballot was valid or not?
Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, members, that is absolutely what I'm saying. At the time that the information comes from the Secretary of State's office, the list, we have the list just like the polls would have the list, and we have nothing more than the list. We don't have information to try to figure out who this person is. If there's an assumption in this that the canvassing board would be given all of that information early on in the process prior to, and I'll do their investigation, I don't see that ever occurring, not with the small length of time, the few days that we have between the close of the polls and canvassing board activities taking place. We wouldn't have any additional information. Thank you.
I have no other member questions for Ms. Geis. We did want to make sure that we were going to get those taken care of for you today. So thanks for hanging in there with us, and again, happy anniversary. With that, we are going to be in recess until 7:30 or the call of the chair. Thank you. I will call for order, I should say reconvene and call for order the Wednesday, March 14, 2017 meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee for the Minnesota House. When we recessed this morning, we had taken all public testimony. We had taken all testifiers who were on the list, and we had one testifier that was left yet, and that's Mr. Peter Nelson. And so at this point, Mr. Nelson, I'm going to ask you to come down and provide your thoughts for us, and then we will go to any other member questions and to Representative Pugh to wrap up the bill. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony. Good evening, sir.
Thank you. Chair, just members of the committee, my name is Peter Nelson. I am a senior policy fellow at the Center for the American Experiment, and I'm here today to support this bill. And I want to begin my testimony here talking a little about provisional balloting and what that is traditionally. Traditionally, provisional balloting has put in place in states where you have where you register 20 days before Election Day. And because we know that there can be errors on that day when you try to register, we allow people, if they come on Election Day to vote and they find there's something wrong with their registration status, we allow them to have a provisional ballot. Obviously, that's not necessary here in Minnesota because we allow people to register on Election Day. So we're not talking about really the traditional provisional balloting. And I think that's very important because provisional balloting does have a negative scent around the country for some possibly good reasons, because provisional balloting, when it's used, can often restrict people's right to vote if it's used very, very, very broadly. There's areas around the country where provisional ballots might be 20 or 30% of the ballots cast, and then a lot of those ballots might not actually count at the end of the day. We're not talking about that system. We're absolutely not talking about that system. We're talking about people who are challenged voters and who are challenged with information, court orders, information from the Department of Public Safety, and information from the Department of Corrections. That is very valid information that we should be able to rely on when it comes to determining whether someone's eligible or not eligible to vote. And right now, we don't really treat that information with, I think, the respect that it's due. And this bill is an effort to do that. And importantly, this information does come from our state. Usually in provisional balloting, the information that we're talking about, the information that's in dispute, is information that the individual actually provided. It's a mistake the individual made or someone doing the registration made. That's what we're talking about in provisional balloting. Here, we're talking about data that's coming straight from our state agencies. And it's reliable data, and we should be using that data to the best extent that we can to guarantee the integrity of our election system. And with that, we have a system in place right now where we use that data and we match against the registered voters list. And if there is a match, we mark that challenged. But that doesn't transfer on election day. On election day, when someone registers, there's nothing in place right now to just to figure out whether that person is trying to register is truly eligible to vote. And that's so that's exactly what we're talking about today. We're not talking about these traditional provisional ballot measures that have such a negative connotation across the country. This is something different, and it is important to the integrity of our election process. I just went online today, and I dug up an election from Woodbury in 2015 where the levy was decided by 5 votes. Just a handful of votes can often matter when it comes to these local elections. And that's why this is important. Even though it might not be a lot of votes in any given election, that doesn't really matter right now at those elections where it's 5 votes, 12 votes, 50 votes. This really does matter. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about the fact that this really is a bill that protects felons. Representative Pugh referenced some cases out of Wilmer earlier today. And those cases are really sad cases where someone probably did think that they could vote. And yet, right now, they're being charged with another felony. One of the individuals in that case, their probation was up in December. And then all of a sudden, they get called from the police in February, and they figured out they're getting charged with yet another felony when they thought everything was done. And that is a very sad scenario, obviously, for these felons. And if it's only happening to 16 felons, as we heard earlier today from the Secretary of State, that's too many. That's too many people being recharged with felony. And this bill will alert those people on election day that they have a felony and that they can't vote. And I think that's maybe equally important in this case to the integrity of the election because, I mean, a second felony for anyone is a disaster. And we are really protecting people from that sort of disaster through this bill. And with that, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. And I'm going to go to Representative Nelson, who has a question of Mr. Nelson, I suspect. Representative Nelson.
And Mr. Chair, as I talked with Peter before that I have my oldest son's name is Peter, so you know, we were talking earlier about same names, and actually the one election official was here earlier, and Mr. Nelson's remarks here, how would this have helped that individual that was brought up, the Collison that was brought up by the election official that was here earlier, that's saying that every year they're listed as they go to the ballot and they're listed because of the state data that comes to the county, that they're listed as a felon and they're being told they can't vote when that person doesn't have that. So how does this bill help that person?
Mr. Nelson, or Representative Pugh, I'm not sure who you wanted to.
I think Mr. Nelson.
Okay. Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson.
I feel like the rest of us are being left out.
I know. How does it help him? I don't think it helps him, but I don't think it harms him either. His vote will count. Right now, he's got to go through a process. There's something screwed up with the process of every year. He is being challenged. And so every year already, he has to go through that. He's got to deal with that on election day. He's got to take the oath. And then he probably has to afterwards go back and talk to the county and figure out why this keeps happening. And so year after year this is happening. You know, it's not going to necessarily help that, but it's not going to harm it either.
Representative Nelson, follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and an additional question. But, Mr. Chair, from the testimony this morning, that's not Scott County's information. That's the information that Scott County gets from the Secretary of State's office, gets from wherever, that says this person. And again, as we said earlier, door knock 7, Mike Nelson's the one here in my district. I went to high school with another Mike Nelson, whose middle initial happened to be later in the alphabet than mine. And there was many times he seemed to be a troublemaker because he got kicked off the bus a couple times. And every time that happened, I got called down to the office because they went through their card file and they pulled the first Mike Nelson out of there, and the V was before his U, and I'm the one that got called out and got the stink eye from everybody in the classroom. What did you do now? And I'd go down there and they'd say, yeah, whatever it was, and I'm going, you got the wrong Mike Nelson. Check the card file again. And they go, oops, never mind. Well, this gentleman we talked about this morning, every year, for whatever reason, it must be such a close match that it comes up every year, and goes to the ballot place, and you can't vote because you're on our list here. Oops, never mind. You've just taken away his voting rights. But with that, Mr. Chair, the other thing I have here is something that Mr. Nelson said in his testimony here is when he said 16 people, the Secretary of State testified that 16 people out of the 3 million people to cast ballots, there were 16 people that registered on Election Day that they're down to from the last election. It wasn't 16 felons, but it's 16 people that they can't verify their voter registration. And so I just want to make that on the record. It wasn't 16 felons. It was 16 people that the counties are investigating now to make sure that they voted properly and get that information. They weren't ever able to track them down through their normal processes.
Other member questions at this time? Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I would like to point out that I believe those 16 people are the people that were eventually charged. That's not saying that 16 people were really actually ineligible. That's all we're talking about, just 16 ineligible people. We're probably talking about a far greater number of ineligible people. That just happens to be the people that were being charged with knowingly voting when they knew that they were ineligible. And because if a police officer goes and follows up on something and they interview an individual, and the individual speaks to them truthfully and tells them that, yeah, I thought I could vote because I was a felon, they can't charge them. And they're not going to go back to the county prosecutor and tell them that you need to investigate this further. That's going to get lost. We have a whole lot of situations like that that get lost in the system. And the whole point here is that we're trying to clean that up. We want to guarantee that those ineligible voters aren't voting. And also that those 16 people that are probably far less than all the ineligible voters that vote, that those 16 people aren't charged with the excruciating process of going through another felon.
Representative Nelson.
Well, just Mr. Chair, like I said, in his testimony, he called these people 16 felons, and as the Secretary of State said, there were 16 people that they still haven't, that are turned over to county attorney's offices to try and track down and try and find out where they are, that they weren't 16 felons. They weren't 16 felons that tried to vote. These were 16 people that they haven't quite yet figured out whether they were eligible to vote or not. And so I just want to make sure the record is correct on that.
He said, she said on this, we actually have a representative from the Secretary of State's office. Maybe we just ask them to review their testimony from earlier this morning. So there isn't a discrepancy on this. Ms. Brother. And it's an information piece. We're certainly not going to be parsing words on this. It's just an information piece. Ms. Strada, if you'd introduce yourself for the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strada with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. I don't remember exactly what Secretary Simon said. I believe it was his words. But my understanding of the number that he quoted were reports from county attorneys to us that they felt had risen to the level that they should report that there appeared to be an incident. But they weren't all charged at this time. So I believe some of them have been charged. I don't have the breakdown. But they were ones that the county attorney felt they rose to the level of needing to report to our office under the rule that requires reporting if they are investigating.
Ms. Feather, thank you for that clarification. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who to direct this question to.
We'll help you.
Thank you. I was looking on line 2.28 with the new additional language in the DE. It makes public information lists that not only include the data that's already out there, name, address, and type of voting, but also adds the reason for the removal. And I'm a little concerned with the cross-references to the statutes listed that talk about commitments, felony, the information from the DOC, and the information from DPS. My reading of the bill, and I maybe counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, all that data now becomes public in part of this, in this list that's supposed to be sent to the county auditor?
Representative Joaquin, I think maybe we'll ask Mr. Gehring for a clarification, and then we'll go to Bill Ott. And then, Mr. Gehring, did you catch the site of the reference site that Representative Joaquin is referring to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, so the public information list, as far as I understand the intent of this bill, is to add additional data about the reason why a voter might be removed from the system. There could be reasons beyond just the challenge process why someone's removed, but the challenge reasons why a voter might be challenged, I think those are all public data to begin with. So it's the data about whether you have a felony conviction, so that would be public. Data whether you're under guardianship would be a public court record, I believe. I'm forgetting
there's all information from DPS is on one statute, and then information from DOC is in the other.
Mr. Chair, I'd maybe defer to Ms. Strother for the specific details of the data that they have.
And maybe clarify which is public and which is private.
Ms. Feather, welcome back. How long has it been since you've been a part of the committee?
About one question. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother again with the Secretary of State's office. We do get data from the Department of Corrections, the Department of Public Safety, and the court system. That data, though, it is part of the statewide voter information list. It is not public data as part of the public information list. It does show up on the roster. So it is possible when you sign into the roster and there's those 10 names on the roster, you might see of the 9 names above you someone with a challenge status. But otherwise, that data is not part of the public information list that we have currently, if that answers your question.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the status of that data that is currently private would then turn public.
Ms. Feather.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. My reading of this bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That concerns me. Mm-hmm. That would kick this bill right over to us.
Civil law, which Representative Nelson mentioned earlier, and that's the point.
So, yeah, because I'm worried that with the Tennyson warning under 13.04.
Which is what Secretary Simon testified to this morning that was referred to by Representative Nelson.
In a while, I've had like a big burger in between, so my brain shut down. So.
This would help with the process. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Pugh, the bill author, did you have a comment, or do we get that taken care of, do you think, from your perspective?
We did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have already made myself that note. I mean, there's much work to do, including the Chapter 13 issues. So,
other member questions at this time? Seeing none, I'm going to talk to Representative Joaquin, Representative Pugh. From earlier this morning, we had some sightings, and you have an amendment that was drafted. I think you're going to speak to it. We know that it's not been to the 24-hour deadline on here, so I think it's just a talking point, and I'll refer to you on what was passed out to members tonight as the A1 amendment to
yes.
the 23rd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe that staff shared the amendment. And this was the oral amendment that I attempted to make this morning, but it was determined based on, I'm not sure how I offered it, that it wasn't needed, but in the time that we've had and knowing that this bill is going to be laid over with continued work, I've asked Mr. Gehring to draft it for any feedback from members. So if I could ask Mr. Gehring to please describe the amendment.
Excellent idea, Representative Pugh. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, so this A1 amendment, as Representative Pugh mentioned, is kind of the codification of the oral amendment that was discussed this morning and the time since this morning's hearing and now. they got a little bit more information about what the intent of the amendment was. So what would happen if this amendment were adopted would be to expand this challenge voter balloting procedure to include voters whose registration status is challenged in the polling place roster prior to Election Day. So in the way that the bill is currently drafted, if you show up in the polling place and register same day and you're challenged based on the Secretary of State's data, you would go through this challenge process. But if you were pre-registered to vote, you wouldn't go through the challenge balloting process. This A1 amendment would change that, so both voters who are registering same day and voters who are pre-registered who have a challenge status on their registration record would go through this challenge balloting process. And Mr. Chair, the voters that would be excluded still from this challenge process would be a voter who is challenged in the polling place based on someone else's personal knowledge of their eligibility.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My brain is still trying to catch up. So you said it would expand it to folks voting, registering the same day to have to go through the challenge process. So this provisional balloting process, but it wouldn't extend it to those that were challenged by, say, a poll watcher. Is that correct?
Mr. Caring.
Mr. Chair, yes. So under this process for processing a challenge ballot, the voters that would be subject to this would be any voter that is challenged based on the data maintained by the Secretary of State. So if you're pre-registered, you'd have that Secretary of State data to use to process challenges, or if you're registering same day, they would have the list of voters who would be challenged that they would use. But if you're a voter who's in the polling place and who's challenged by a neighbor or someone else in line based on that neighbor's personal knowledge of your status, you would not go through this process.
Okay, so
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So those registering same day, it would be applicable to the matching them up to the polling roster of challenged voters, somebody who's a felony or the list. But if their name is not on that list, they've cross-referenced it, then they would not have to go through the challenge process if they're newly registered that day.
Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, yes, that's
thank you.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Gehring. That was my intent, to ensure that all voters are treated equitably.
And Representative Pugh, we are going to lay it over, but if you wanted to make some quick summation points, and then we'll get on to other bills that you have here with us this evening as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just first want to say thank you so very much for all of the feedback, all of the robust conversation. I greatly appreciate it. I've had an opportunity since this morning's hearing to speak with and receive feedback from the Scott County Auditor Treasurer. I saw when Cindy was here her notes, and she had a lot of prepared notes and then some handwritten notes as well. And I asked her if she wouldn't mind sharing those with me in addition to her handwritten notes. So I've received those, and I look forward to going through those. I also have reviewed now Secretary of State Simon's letter specific to this bill. As I mentioned earlier, I had previously looked at his concerns about Senate File 717, so I look forward to working through that as well. And as you maybe noticed, I took copious notes from many of the comments, and I'll look forward to recapping those too. So if there's any concern, and I'm sure that there is, that anyone has, please don't hesitate to share with me. So thank you very much.
And with that, I will lay over House File 2039 as amended for possible inclusion if there is an elections bill this year. Members, as we are waiting for our next bill to come forward, we do have a housekeeping item. Representative Joaquin, if you had a chance to review the minutes from the March 10th meeting.
Mr. Chair, yes, I did earlier this morning, and they are fine. I'd like to move the minutes from the March 10th meeting.
Representative Joaquin moves the March 10th minutes. Any questions? Seeing none, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion carries. Representative Pugh, I think we'll take them in the order that we have. How about we do 2271 at this time? And I will move House File 2271 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill, should there be one from this committee this year. Representative Pugh, the House File 2271.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to mention about this particular bill. In fact, maybe we could do this now. I know that it's being laid over, too late for an amendment. But this morning when Mr. Kent Sulem, I'm going to ask him to come down, brought to my attention an unintended consequence from my bill. And so what I've asked him to do is work with Mr. Gehring, and they've drafted an amendment that you have, I believe you have. No? Oh, it's being passed. And
any of members who, yes. Sorry, Representative, we will not be taking action on it. Representative Pugh wanted us to have this so that we could see what her bill would look like with some conversation. As she's indicated, she likes to do with outside folks to get a better product for all of us. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Representative Pugh.
Yes, and thank you. And so what I would like to do is I would like to ask Mr. Sulem to describe what the amendment would do.
Mr. Sulem, welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent, proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I think it's appropriate for me to try an elections bill today because it is Township Day. Polls will close in approximately 11 minutes for approximately 1,200 of the 1,800 townships having their elections tonight.
You timed this so you could do a commercial for the township state.
Mr. Chair, sometimes it pays to be lucky. Mr. Chair, members, what the A1 and House Bill 2271 as drafted was the intended to try to help provide local governments with a list of people who would be willing to travel and serve as a judge. Unfortunately, the way it was drafted, it created an unfunded mandate where that list would become part of the mandatory list that had to be exhausted before you could go outside and find other judges. We worked very closely with a number of you several years back to get rid of that system because we were having to pay people to commute from Rochester to Thief River Falls to serve as an election judge, and that didn't seem to make much sense. However, if there are willing volunteers out there who would like to travel and are not demanding to be paid for that, then that list would be very helpful. And that's what the A1 amendment would accomplish. It would clarify that the list for Representative Pugh's bill is a secondary list of those who are not inside the normal jurisdiction, that the lists that are required to be provided through the Secretary of State's office to the counties and then the counties down to the locals, that would remain the same. There would be a second list of these voluntary, we're willing to travel anywhere people. And then if a community opted to use those people because they couldn't find anybody else closer, the amendment also clarifies that there would not be a mandatory pay. They could opt, if that's what it takes to get somebody to serve, or they're wanting to be generous, they could cover costs, but they would not be required to cover the travel expense to, say, go from Rochester to Thief River, which is what led to the original change to the law as we have it.
Questions of Mr. Sulem? Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you to Mr. Sulem for having brought this to my attention. I wanted to just share with members how this this amendment, how this bill came to be. I've lived in Carver County for 30 years, and a number of years ago, I believe it was in 2010, had a large group of friends that wanted to serve as election judges, poll challengers, and in Carver County, we have the fortune of having plenty of election judges. So there were way more election judges than there was a need, and poll challengers than there was a need for those to serve. And so a number of my friends and acquaintances were willing to travel to Minneapolis, to St. Paul. You know, they went all over. Logistically, it was very, very challenging for them to figure out, like, who to connect with, how to get there. A number of them noted that, they were all Republicans, and those who served in Minneapolis found that there weren't, you know, many Republicans there. So I just thought that this would be a really good idea for the party who, you know, knows who their volunteers are to be informing the counties and then therefore the precincts as to who might be available should Republican election judges, should Democrat election judges, should independent party election judges be wanted or needed in a particular polling place. So that's how this came to be.
Members, questions? Again, we're not taking the amendment, and we do have 2271 before us. Questions? Thoughts on the bill? Representative Pugh, I'm just going to make one quick comment for you on this issue of some communities in my district having people who are more willing to step up to help. We have had the fortune of being able to share people with other jurisdictions because we just have qualified judges who, for various reasons, because they were ineligible because they themselves might have been a candidate in a race in that area, but when they moved to a different community to serve in that, they were not. Or they are related to someone who's on the ballot, which would disqualify them in that community, or otherwise people who would be very interested in serving. And these are even nonpartisan type races that we're talking about. And it's becoming, just like volunteer firefighters, more and more difficult to find people to step up in those roles who are willing to do those kinds of things and take off their personal time to do that. And I think that you're onto something here with trying to be able to allow people that opportunity to be able to transcend boundaries and jurisdictions to provide support for our elected processes. So I laud your work on this.
Thank you.
With that, I will lay over House File 2271. And the final bill before us today is House File 2344. And Representative Pugh, with that, I will move House File 2354. And I will lay that over for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill if there's going to possibly be one this year. Representative Pugh, I think that there's also an oral incorporation that you need to make here that will be consistent with some of the work that we do here, but I'm not going to speak for you. I'm going to let you speak for yourself on that. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, there is an oral amendment, and I believe that Mr. Gehring has that amendment drafted. So I'd like to have him share that at this time, and then I will explain the amendment.
I don't think it's an amendment as much as it is an oral incorporation for clarification purposes. Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, so the clarification would be on the bill, line 1.13, you'd reinstate the stricken 42 and delete 30. And then also on line 1.16, you would delete 30 and insert 28. So with that change, then the deadlines for the counties to upload their data would be 42 days after they were with an additional period of 28 days after that if the county can't comply initially.
And I'm going to ask Ms. Brother to maybe speak to that from a practical standpoint under statute, because those numbers, when you divide them by seven, you get even numbers, and I suspect that they're 7 days in a week, and that kind of fits into some of the stuff that we need to be looking at. So I don't mean to take away your thunder, but go ahead, Ms. Brother, identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Secretary of State. Yes, it does have to do with we like to count things by 7 days. The two 30-day periods that were in here would actually have the second deadline end up on a Saturday. And so allowing this to be, we do count by days generally with elections, but this is a six-week first deadline, and then it would be a 10-week second deadline. And that just as background lines up with when you have to mail out postal verification cards. So we appreciate the author's willingness to work with us in finding those dates that works with the timeline for election administration.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gehring, a committee member had brought forward that line 1.14 might also need to be addressed. I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Mr. Chair, yes. So if the committee chose to, you could also reinstate the 42-day and 1.14, but this is being drafted, we kept that out because you're repeating the deadline twice in the same sentence. So it's even clearer to just have the deadline appear once.
So just with the two incorporations?
So I think those two incorporations accomplish the objective that Representative Pugh has.
If there's any objection, we'll incorporate those into House File 2354. I will make those incorporations to the bill, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just very quickly, this bill came about when I went down to the Secretary of State's office a number of times, and starting in January, to purchase the statewide voter registration disk. And only to learn that it wasn't ready yet, not available to order, because there were still a number of counties that were out for whatever reason, nothing nefarious. But there was this 42-day requirement, and then if they wanted an extension, they were granted one, but there was no end. And so we thought it would be, we agreed on this, that it would be good to set some parameters to ensure that all of the data was input and that our data was solid. So,
Ms. Brother, as a representative of the Secretary of State's office, this does affect your office. I'll be here happy to hear what you have to say on the matter.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we agree with the author. Right now we have a deadline in statute, but once the deadline is waived and they've asked for permission to go past the deadline, there's no second deadline. And for a lot of our counties, particularly those that wear multiple hats and are doing multiple jobs, if you don't have a second deadline, you know, the work just tends to fall to the bottom of the to-do pile. And because we do have this deadline at 10 weeks where you're supposed to be sending out postal verification cards to everyone who registered on Election Day, we felt it was really appropriate to have that second deadline at the 10-week period when they have to send out the card. So we appreciate this, and we have spoken with several counties, and I don't want to speak for the counties. They can come up here and testify if they'd like to, but my understanding is that this timeline generally works, particularly with the provision that we can waive the obligation if there's good cause shown, some sort of, you know, loss of employment staff or something like that. But this should work for us.
Mm-hmm. We don't have any member questions at this time. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on the matter before the committee? Seeing none and hearing none, no member questions. Representative Pugh will give you the final and brief word on this one.
Thank you, members. I appreciate your being back this evening, and have a wonderful rest of your evening. I'm done.
With that, I will lay over House File 2354 as incorporated for possible inclusion in the 2017 Omnibus Elections Bill. Should there be one? Members, with that, we are adjourned.